And a very good day to you, my friend. Wherever you may be in this little marble we call the Earth, you are locked in to Son of a Pitch here with Michael Cuenca. That's me, my friend, Michael Cuenca, taking my hat off to you for putting this fine-ass episode into your eardrums and letting it trickle like the sweet black gold of drip coffee it is to wake you the fuck up and bring you some realness. And let's do a little deep dive, a little exploration into a funny little thing called setting boundaries. That's right, it's the Boundary Show. Let's get to it. I hate losing. Now, not necessarily in the way that you think. Maybe it could be in the way that you think. I don't know what you're thinking, so that's up to you. But I hate losing. What's even worse is losing stuff you've already won. Let me give you an example. You spend a long time developing a really kick-ass relationship with a client. Or with someone, doesn't matter, they're interchangeable. You got some nice back and forth, you hang out, you discover you have some shared interests. You learn that there are things that you can do for them that you can help them out with, and vice versa. They could bring you into the fold, show you the pictures on the wall, if you will, of their business, and get you acquainted with what they do and what they're passionate about. For a couple of years, you start thinking to yourself, wait a minute, there might be something that we can develop here. But if they don't see the same thing, it's time for you to get it going. Sometimes that happens faster. Sometimes you get a client, or clients come to you if you're lucky, asking you for such amazing things to help them with, and you can totally do it. And that's what's amazing, you can actually solve their problems. But for some reason, either their internal support isn't there yet, or budgets aren't available yet, or for some reason there's something standing in the way. They live just a bit too far away from you, or they're just eat a little bit too far away. Who knows? For whatever reason, you have to decline working with them. That, for someone that loves connecting, growing, helping, working with people, and sales even, that is a dagger through the heart, my friends. That, for me, really stings. Because I think deep down, what it says to me is that even though I can help them, I can't. Or if I want to be a responsible business owner and look at the priorities and the people that are willing to pay my rate, for example, or to work with me and do whatever it takes to do that, those people deserve my attention because they are willing and value my work with them enough to say, hey, let's just work together. Let's solve some shit. Let's GSD, man. Let's get some shit done. But it doesn't mean that everyone that comes through to my messages, my emails, my inboxes, that I don't want to help each and every single person that comes in, but I literally have to be reeled in. It's almost like I have a very particular set of skills that make me suitable to helping a shitload of people present themselves better, or to get investment, or to close that next deal that'll help them survive for the next 6 months. It's the stories I hear, the ideas I get to see that I want to be a part of and help, but can't. That is what I hate losing. I don't actually hate losing in terms of a fair competition. I actually encourage that. I think I made this comment to my wife the other day. When we're talking about friends and family and people that have to deal with putting all their energy into one thing and it not working out, and then they just give up. Whereas I use the example of good old friend Elon, my longtime bromigo, Mr. Muskies. No, I'm kidding. He has no idea I exist. Elon Musk builds fucking rockets. Rockets! And they do so at, like, a breakneck pace for rocket building. It literally is rocket science. And they're doing it by failing and iterating. Every failure they make, every fuck-up, is an opportunity for them to deep dive into that particular challenge, and then they come back with something even better. They started with, like, what is it, like 36 rockets at one point, and then dropped it down to, like, 28. Pretty soon, they're just gonna put, like, a little spring on the ass of one of the rockets that'll be so tightly loaded that it'll just fucking launch these guys into space. They won't even need rockets anymore. Won't even need rockets. No more methane. I don't know what I'm talking about, because I'm not a rocket scientist. But these rocket scientists fail on purpose with the intent to actually keep going. And you can see that kind of attitude in how Elon speaks to peers in the industry. Another rocket recently failed in some other company out there. And he tweets out, he's just like, you know what, man, I feel you. Good luck, I'm pretty sure you'll get it. Rockets are hard, but your team is good, that kind of thing. You need to support each other in this space. It's brand new. And same with discovering new opportunities and new people and connecting with new ideas. It's all brand new and it's all super exciting. But sometimes you have to really pick your battles. Sometimes you have to pick the focus you want to do. And for example, if you're launching and building and growing a brand new company that's focused on areas that are similar but adjacent to what you used to do, it's hard to turn around and say to the people that you used to work with that, hey man, or hey lady, shit's getting serious. And we're really going to be taking this rocket ship up into the atmospheres. And I'd love to bring you along with me, but if you don't want to be a part of it, or can't, or for some reason don't have the capacity, position, wherewithal to do so, then I'm sorry, I'm going to have to say no. I'm going to have to lose that client. I could literally see myself, when saying these things, losing these clients that I would love to work with. Because behind every project, every cool thing, are people. People that really want to help others. And if I can be in that capacity where I can help those people who want to help other people, shit, that's like, I get to exponentialify my helpingness. So rather than just helping one person, you know, rather than giving a man a fish or giving a person a fish, and rather than teaching a person to fish, I'd be like putting online courses on fishing and then showing it with the world to teach millions of people. That's the kind of impact I want to have. But unfortunately, up until now, I've been a freelancer. And freelancing is awesome because you get to, you know, you get to really choose what you want to do, who you want to help, where you want to go. Establishing a business is slightly different. You can still decide what you want to do, where you want to go, but there are slightly slower, slightly more nuanced elements in running a company, especially with partners, to navigate. And you have to take their interests into mind, which, you know, I know it sounds weird, but for me, someone who's run his own shop, you know, with, you know, loosely spoken sort of partners, people I worked with, people I brought into the project because I knew they can get shit done. That's not easy. It's a tough sort of switch. But it requires me to be a little bit more stringent, a little bit stricter with my boundaries, with some of the people that ask me for help, some of the companies that come to me for help, some big companies too, that for whatever reason, maybe they just don't, they can't. They can't meet to where I need to, what levels I need, what levels we need to work together for me to feel valued, for you to get the best work out of it. It is a relationship. And unfortunately, if some people only see a certain amount of value out of you, and you're worth so much more, you owe that value. You owe your self-worth. You owe it to yourself to say no. To actually say, no, I'm sorry. I'd love to work with you. I'd love to spend more time helping the people you help. But this is just not, it's not working for me. That's what I hate. I hate having to lose clients, having to say to them, listen, I'm sorry, we can't work together, even though I know they want to. They're literally, it's almost like they're standing in front of you, about to hand you their money, saying, I want to work with you, and you're just saying, no. And I guess if we put an objective hat, we take the emotion, the ego out of this picture. We look at it like if we're going shopping, and I want to buy a milk, a carton of milk, a gallon of milk, a liter of cola. If I want to buy a liter of cola, and it costs $2.50, and I only have a buck, I can't go up to the cashier and say, hey, I only have a buck, but this costs $2.50. They'd be like, get the fuck out of here. Go put that shit back on the aisles. It'll cost us more to actually go and put it back yourself. You go put it back. Fucking liter of cola. Go out there. But if I come in there and say, listen, I got $500. I want to buy the entire store. If I want to go, you know, Mr. Beast on this shit and just buy out the entire store, then I should be able to. And the store should be able to oblige that. It's basic economics. Double coincidence of wants and needs. And so when people can't recognize that, sometimes it helps to have to say no. But saying no, losing that client, for me at least, is fucking painful. I hate it. Now all this has, okay, so what does this have to do with entrepreneurship? What is this, aside from me having an issue with losing? There's psychology behind this. There's the notion of loss aversion. That literally, from what I readings with Chris Voss in his book, Never Split the Difference, it basically, in there, he says that loss aversion can actually bend people's reality. People's resistance or reluctance to lose what they have keeps them up at night. It, you know, makes them restless. Nobody loses sleep over the fact that I'm making more money tomorrow than I did yesterday, or that everything is growing in the perfect sense. No, people lose sleep when they're possibly, I'm gonna lose my house, I'm gonna lose my rent, how am I gonna pay my bills, how am I gonna feed my kids, how am I gonna get to work tomorrow? Loss aversion, the fear of loss, is a powerful, powerful motivator that can really fuck with people's mindsets and bend their perception of reality and their understanding and appreciation of what they have. So what does this have to do with what I'm talking about with entrepreneurship, with business, with planning, with everything? Well, beyond setting your own boundaries and recognizing when you need to say no to smaller clients or clients that don't want to grow with you, and beyond the sense of perceived loss that you have with doing that, with saying no, you feel like you're losing a possible client, maybe on an internal level, I need to start looking at things like the opportunity cost of that time spent on people that actually matter, people that actually will value and fund and pay for things, for my services, for my partner's advice, for our involvement with them, as opposed to those that won't. And maybe the problem with loss aversion here that I'm talking about has more to do with how you manage your own perception of reality. Now, in terms of how you use and leverage loss aversion for example, sales or acquisitions, it's pretty straightforward. It's rather than framing things like all the stuff that you're going to get, which is my problem. And I think this is the issue here, is that in my mind, I'm going through all the things I can possibly do with them, all the help I can give them, all the, you know, support I can help with, all the thousands of people I can help as a consequence, all the potential. I get caught up in that. And so do people. Positives really are a great motivator to get someone hooked into something. But then when I start thinking about the loss by saying no, I start thinking about, holy shit, I'm not going to be able to have this client. But instead, maybe I should switch that. Maybe people like myself should switch that into, what about if I say no to this person, that means I can say yes to two more people that actually will value my stuff. Playing with loss aversion doesn't work just when you're selling someone something. It works when you're trying to shift your own perception of that reality. And that's my biggest lesson. That's my biggest learning, at least this week so far. It's really testing me. It's really bugging me. But I mean, it's part of the life of running a shop, part of the life of being a business owner. This is just what happens. And so as a consequence, I need to learn how to be more stoic, I think. Take the ego out of it, take the emotion out of it, and focus on how I can allocate my time more intelligently. Let me just loop back and close that little loophole I left open there about loss aversion in sales and perception. It's a huge motivator. You can really bend people's reality by playing with their concept of loss. And the example that Chris Voss gives is a pretty good one. He says, for example, and I've used this one too in some outreach, and it works brilliantly. I say, for example, in some LinkedIn outreaches, I say to people, listen, I can help make your job 1,000 times easier, but you don't have to connect with me. You don't even have to hit okay and accept, but know that every day, every hour, every minute that we're not working together, your job is 100 times harder than it could be. Rather than saying that someone's going to save thousands of dollars, you can say that without our product, you're losing thousands of dollars. Framing it in terms of loss makes it more salient. It's also why people start off with the problems when they're pitching things. The more you talk about the things that are in the way of us living that easy, chill life, the more realistic it becomes for people in their minds. Now, while we're still on the subject of loss aversion and how that bends reality, there's a little secret to getting around the challenge of bending reality. There's a little trick to getting around people playing with your loss aversion. And it's somewhat difficult. It's somewhat challenging because it involves a certain degree of emotional intelligence, so EQ, that I'm going to be honest with you guys, it's fucking hard for someone like me. I'm an emotional guy. I'm a passionate guy. I got some energies that come out of God knows where. It really is just, you know, it tingles. Can you feel it tingling? I know you can feel it tingling. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening. But the trick to really getting over the challenge of being crazy emotional, or just at the very least of letting your ego get in the way of making decisions, is in being more stoic. And that's pretty easy to say. What does that actually mean? What does being stoic mean? And there's some examples in some of the books that I've read before that are brilliant. One book by Roger Fisher and William Ury is called Getting to Yes. Fisher came up with another book afterwards. I think it was Fisher or Ury. One of them came up with another book afterwards, Getting Past No. But the interesting bit here that's related to Stoicism is that they argue, and I have the book right here, is that when challenged, when faced with tough negotiations, your counterpart will use emotions to fuck with you. They will try to bend your reality. They'll try to goad you into making unwise agreements. They'll push it. And it'll go on and on and on. Maybe you'll reach an agreement, maybe not, who knows. But what's interesting here is what they say is that the moment you get into an emotional negotiation, the moment you get into a negotiation that involves more adversarial, more aggressive kind of language and approach, the more important it is to exercise what they call positional bargaining, or even more importantly, to exercise what they call going to the balcony. Let me tell you a little bit about going to the balcony. One of the big insights that they have in this book, Getting to Yes, is that you need to, in any negotiation, separate the people from the problem. And that's always been my challenge. How do you separate the people from the problem? It's these schmucks that are creating the fucking problem in the first place. How do you say we have nothing to do with the problem when the problem lies squarely on your fucking shoulders? It's your fault. Not your fault, but it's all you're doing. If you were just going along with the shit that I needed to get done, we wouldn't have this problem. But Ury and Fisher say here, you need, in principle negotiation or negotiation on sort of merits, can be boiled down to 4 basic points. These 4 points deal with a basic element of negotiation and suggest what you should do about it. These 4 points involve the people, the interests, the opinions, and the criteria. First off, like I said, you separate the people from the problem. Second, you focus on interests and not positions. And third, for options, come up with a range of possibilities before figuring out what to do. Look at your options. Come up with options. Brainstorm together on options. And then lastly, and this is their Harvard-style kind of measure the success rate of negotiation, insist that the result be based on some kind of objective standard. That last bit, Chris Voss may disagree with. You don't necessarily need an objective measure. If you reach your objective, then you've reached your objective. No need to fuss around with that. But at the core, what they're really trying to say here is that negotiators are people first. You're not dealing with abstract representatives of the other side, but with actual people. They have emotions, values, different backgrounds, viewpoints, and most of all, they are unpredictable, as are you. And so this human nature in negotiations can either be helpful or completely mindfuckeries. It can be completely disastrous. The process of working out an agreement may actually create or lead to a psychological commitment, something that works for both of you. A working relationship where trust, understanding, respect, and friendship are built up over time can make each new negotiation smoother and more efficient. And people's desire to feel good about themselves and their concern for what others will think of them can often make them more sensitive to another negotiator's interests. So essentially, the more you strive to build a trust-based relationship, the easier negotiations becomes with that party over time. And on the other hand, people get hostile, angry, depressed, offended. They get egos that are easily threatened sometimes. They see the world just from their own lenses without any attempt to consider your shoes or any semblance that they'll go walking in them. Often, they fail to interpret what you say in the way you intend to and don't mean, and instead confuse what you are trying to say. Misunderstanding here can actually reinforce prejudice and lead to reactions that lead to counter-reactions in a fucking terrible vicious circle. Rational exploration of solutions becomes impossible. Negotiations fall apart. So the purpose of the game here becomes about scoring points in that sense, confirming negative impressions and assigning blame at the expense of the actual interests behind both parties. If you fail to deal with others, this is what he's really saying here, is if you fail to deal with others like humans, prone to human reactions, whatever else you're doing at any point during a negotiation, from prep to follow-up, it's worth asking yourself, am I paying enough attention to the people problem here? Because if you fail to deal with others like human beings, you can seriously fuck up your negotiation. So I started this by saying there's a technique to overcome this particular challenge, to overcome the influence of emotions in negotiations. And one of them is actually just to name them. Make the emotions explicit. There's a study that was done a while ago that actually had people look at a bunch of faces, and they studied the brain patterns of subjects. And whenever the subjects mentioned the emotion that they were feeling, the intensity of that emotion in their brain subsided. So actually naming and articulating the emotion that you're feeling, or that your counterpart might be feeling, has a way of mitigating or interfering or subduing the intensity of that emotion. So if I could say something like, it sounds like, or it looks like, or it seems like you're stressed or angry about the way things are headed. And then you can confirm it. Or you can use that as misinformation, for example, and get them to correct you. Who knows? But naming emotions is one technique. Another is letting the other people, let off some steam. Let them express themselves and hopefully eventually name enough of their emotions so that it ends up subsiding and ends up making them feel more at ease. But perhaps the best strategy to adopt while the other side names and lets off their steam, if you will, is to actually just not respond. Don't answer their attacks. They're bound to attack you. But just be quiet. Ask them to continue until they feel like they've let everything out. Another thing is, and this is another thing that's really difficult for me to do sometimes, what they say is that sometimes you might need to use symbolic gestures just to diffuse tense and emotional situations. What does that mean? That means that these are basically acts that will lead to a constructive emotional impact on one side and don't really cost you anything. It's something as simple as apologizing, for example. A lot of times, an apology can actually diffuse emotions. And even when you don't acknowledge personal responsibility for the action or admit an intention to harm, an apology can actually be the easiest, least costly, and most rewarding investment you can make in that negotiation. So these are some things that you can do that'll help mitigate it. But one of my favorite things is actually what they call going to the balcony. So here's a situation. You're in a negotiation or you're in a tough situation or some douchebag pisses you off. You realize, and I'm borrowing this a bit from Jocko Willink as well. He made a comment a little while ago in one of his books is that every time he feels emotional, he tries to consciously say, that's ego. Every time his emotions get the best of him, every time he feels angry or bottled up or frustrated or whatever, any emotion about a situation, he names it, says that's ego. And he does in that naming process what we talked about. We also, it allows him to more effectively go to what Fisher and Uri call the balcony, which is essentially put yourself in a spectator's shoes. Look at what a spectator would see objectively without any emotion on the situation. And then take that and then look at the situation. Separate the people from the problem, from the situation. And look at the situation itself with cold, fresh eyes. And maybe, just maybe, you'll be able to get around the stress and tension that some negotiations tend to bring out. Or some situations, even. Another, and the last bit, another little tidbit that has sort of helped me is I've been reading a lot about The Obstacle is the Way by Ryan Holiday, and he basically tracks Marcus Aurelius, the legend of Stoicism. And in this, Marcus Aurelius advocates a very objective approach to dealing with situations. And once you take yourself out of the picture, things become a lot easier to manage. And it is so crazy easy for me to say that. Honestly, it's easy. It literally is the definition of easier said than done. Because, I don't know, maybe it's the way, maybe it's the tools that I have. I don't necessarily, I mean, I'm developing the tools to be able to manage and handle these kind of tensions, but it's not always easy. As an entrepreneur, it is one of my Achilles heels, as is a lot of people's. My passion, my enthusiasm, my EQ, my emotionalness, while being supremely helpful in identifying insights and trying to articulate what really matters to people, can sometimes be pretty challenging when it comes to separating myself from the issues. I get involved, I get passionate, I care about my clients, my family, my friends, the people that matter. So it's hard sometimes to step back, but it is by definition an exercise. And frankly, because it makes me feel uncomfortable, because it's a sense of discomfort, I think that's where the real growth happens. In all instances, whenever I had to go through something that made me feel really uncomfortable, really stressed, I've really grown from it. There was a year where, when I first started out as a freelancer, oh my God, the sales were shit. Oh, it was terrible. I look back and I'm like, how did I even survive then? And then I saw the year after, I doubled it. The year after that, doubled the returns, tripled the returns. It's to the point where years later, thousands of percentages greater in terms of overall returns since that first new client. And that's all because of just a dedication and persistence and focus on just getting shit done. And I couldn't have done that if I allowed myself to get caught up in emotional things that came up that other people tried to throw at me. And I've had some shit thrown at me. I've done plenty of shit slinging myself, mind you. But exercising a sense of objectivity, stoicism, discipline, rational assessments allows you to keep a clean, level head when everyone else is busy freaking the fuck out and trying to use that freak out to their advantage. And there are bullies like that. They yell and scream and think that that's going to make something happen. And sometimes it does, but that's just because the people just don't want to deal with it. They don't want to hear you yelling and screaming anymore, so they just give in. And that reinforces the bully's techniques. Makes them feel like, shit, if I do this again, then I'll get what I want. But that's not effective. It's not efficient. It's tiring for everyone, bully included. It just doesn't really work out. And so I guess what I'm really trying to say here is that when confronted with emotional challenges and situations, the fear of loss that can trigger and elicit a lot of emotions, it's helpful to try and go to the balcony. Take a step back. Really try to assess the situation as objectively as possible. And then you can jump in, make your moves, and then get what you want. That's just some food for thought. If it works for you, it works. If it works for me, who knows? I've been trying it. It's an ongoing process. Life, the universe, and everything is itself an ongoing stream of what the fuckeries. But hey, if this helps you, kudos. Use it. Be my guest. So that brings us to the sad yet ultimate conclusion of today's rant on boundary setting, stoicism, saying no when it means that you get to say yes, and the life lessons and what the fuckery is that is running your own business and dealing with that shit. It's some tough stuff, man. It's not easy. But to be honest with you, I don't know if I'd have it any other way. I love this. I love what I do. I love the people I help and the things that I get to do. And it's amazing and fun. And the ideas I get to be around are insane. So sometimes just the discomfort of things that you may need to improve on really just signals for you to double down and really work on that element. To double down and really work on improving that part about yourself. And that is the journey that I, and I guess other entrepreneurs like me, are going on. So here's to you peeps, the entrepreneurs in Dutch, the ondernemers, the hustlers, the hardcore, late night, ass-kicking motherfuckers, giving you mad props for just doing what you're doing and persisting, sometimes in the face of complete and utter stupidity or things that people think are stupid. Just, you know, mad respect. Keep on doing what you're doing. And that includes listening to this phenomenal podcast. So thanks for spending the time to listen to what I'm talking about. Doing some little brainwave, brain tingles. Hopefully you've done some mental gymnastics here, but I will love you and leave you at this point. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time. Have a good one. All right, thanks so much for listening to another exciting episode of Son of a Pitch. I hope you learned something. I know I did. It was kind of revelatory. This is sort of like the Dr. Phil of the internet, where I just get the vomit onto the ones and zeros and see what sticks. Hopefully something did. If it didn't, we got a floor cleanup to mop up in a little bit. But what's most important, beyond growth, is that you like and share the fucking podcast. Come on, people, get with me over here. And until then, until next week, until next time that you and I get to share a few minutes together, I want to wish you a fantastic day. Because you're freaking awesome. Because you made it this far. Because you are a loyal subscriber to Son of a Pitch with Michael Goenka. So until then, stay classy, stay sassy, stay hydrated, give zero fucks what other people think, and have a wicked day. Bye for now.